The GoFundMe site indicates Eva will require extensive hospital care and mental and physical rehabilitation. Quote, Eva is very concerned about paying for her bills and the needs of her two children, 5 and 6 years old, it indicates. The crowdsourcing page raised about $500 in its first 3 hours on Tuesday. Supporters hope to generate $10,000. Coming up on 10 and a half minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD sports and weather. First in the NBA, the Bucks and Bulls both idle last night. Both teams are back into action tonight. Both teams play at home. The Bucks host Portland. The Bulls host Phoenix. NHL, Blackhawks off last night as well. They play Washington tonight. And then coming up tomorrow, NFL Thursday football. Well, Thanksgiving Day. The Bears meet the Lions. First game at 11:30. Redskins play the Cowboys at 3:30. Falcons and Saints meet at 7:20. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. For today, Wednesday the 21st, cloudy and cold, a high of 33, overnight 22 degrees. Tomorrow, Thursday, Thanksgiving, partly sunny and 37. Right now, wind from the west at 6, 32 degrees Racine, 31 now in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On the eve of yet another Thanksgiving, I am very, very grateful indeed for the opportunity to speak with the co-authors of a book called The 7 Laws of Enough, Cultivating a Life of Sustainable Abundance. Isn't that a beautiful title? And this conversation could not be more timely. Quite aside from the Thanksgiving holiday, I think in many respects, American society and probably people in other societies as well, in other parts around the globe, are kind of grappling with the whole notion of, do I have enough? What is the meaning of the word enough? And what does it mean to have a truly abundant life? What matters most in life? And how can I sow the things that matter the most to me? A lot of intriguing questions are brought up in this beautifully written book by Gina LaRoche and Jennifer Cohen. They are co-founders of something called the Seven Stones Leadership Group, and they do a lot of consultant work and speaking and coaching, trying to lead individuals and organizations towards a path of greater abundance. And their lovely book, The 7 Laws of Enough, is published by Parallax Press. And they are both joining me on the phone to talk about their book. Gina LaRoche, Jennifer Cohen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you for having us. Oh, Greg. Thank you, Greg. Thank you for having us.
I'm happy to have you here. I really, really am. One matter I want to get out of the way is that this is a book that is written, I think, for the most part, with people who have a fair amount in their lives and yet maybe live sort of oblivious to that fact. I mean, who in a sense have enough and yet don't really realize that they have enough and are caught up in this thing that you call the scarcity story, which we will explore in just a little bit. I wonder if we could just right off the bat talk about the really sad reality that, in fact, there are a lot of people who are not living lives like you and I are living, and who really are contending with what I think anybody would say is, in fact, a life of scarcity. It's nothing that they are imagining, that for whatever reason, perhaps for no fault of their own, perhaps for some fault of their own, but find themselves living in very grim circumstances in terms of what they have and with what they are contending. I wonder if you could just speak to that and answer maybe this basic question of, is this book and what you are laying out also for somebody like that? Or is this book primarily conceived for those who, in fact, have enough but need to come to understand that they have enough?
Can I take it, Gina?
Yes, Jen, why don't you take that?
Yeah. I would say, Greg, that it's accurate to say that the book is primarily conceived for people more like you and me, in a sense, who have our basic needs met and maybe even some number of our wants met and are contending more with what we call the mindset of scarcity. That said, we distinguish in the book three kinds of scarcity, three levels of scarcity. And the first is this mindset of scarcity that applies maybe more to people like you and me. The second is what we call interpersonal scarcity, where we start to believe that if only you, Greg, would do more for me, or you would do less of something, I would be okay. And we see this in marriages, we see this in teams, in families. Somehow your lack or your excess is making me unhappy. And the third level is what we call structural scarcity, and that's what you're speaking to. And structural scarcity is about the fact that 30,000 children will die today of hunger. And they will not die today of hunger because there is not enough food on planet Earth. That is not why they will die. They will die because we have erected structures that are based on a mindset of scarcity. So there's an interconnection between the mindset and then what actually starts to arise on the planet in terms of how we erect systems that reflect that mindset. And those systems are very real, as you say, for millions of people all over the globe.
Right. And I should think then that in this, in a sense, your book has rich potential for all of us wherever we are, and not just in the sense of helping us, in a sense, understand our own lives and our own scarcity versus abundance, whatever that might be. But also helps us understand that as it plays out in the lives of others around us, and maybe helps us to be less oblivious and maybe more understanding of that. Is it safe to say that your book can also be that for a reader?
Yes, I think the book does focus on the interconnection that we have, that we are part of a larger community, And that community is, you know, your family, your neighborhood, your town, your organization, your team. And so when we think of community, we're thinking about it on a bunch of different levels. And that interconnection is what we say is more important than the accumulation of things, the accumulation of wealth, and noticing that the scarcity in our relationships, in our connections, can cause us a lot of suffering. Now, there's also scarcity in money. You know, there's never enough money. And we also talk about the third pain point is there's scarcity of time. We always feel like, oh, I need another. I always say, God, I need an eighth day of the week. That's my thing. I need another day. But I think the critical aspect of this conversation really is in this conversation about connection, belonging, and to not forget that we are all interconnected.
One thing I also wanted to mention that I appreciated about the book is that although you are not coming, as far as I can tell, from any particular religious framework or from any particular life of faith or don't seem to be writing from that. I don't know anything about who you are in your private lives, but my sense is, as someone reading this who happens to be a person of religious faith, of relatively conventional religious faith, if I might say that, that folds very nicely, actually, into what you have written here. In other words, someone from such a perspective need not discard all that in order to take up some other sort of, in a sense, radical rethinking that would be, in a sense, at odds with what one might believe, for instance, about where our blessings come from, for instance. Can you just speak to that and whether or not that was really a conscious choice on your part to shape the book in this kind of way?
Nina, can I say something about that?
Sure.
Thank you. That's a fabulous compliment from both of our points of view. I'm going to speak for you, Gina. We come from different religious backgrounds, Gina and I both do. And I think almost every wisdom tradition distilled down has ultimately similar understandings of our place in the universe, a way to orient to life. And we really, this was meant to be non-denominational, secular, and possess a certain amount of wisdom about life itself. And I think that crosses at least every religion that I have had some exposure to its teachings. The wisest parts of that religion, of all religions, sound really similar. So thank you for saying that. It was our intention to make it accessible to as many people of as many backgrounds and as many faiths as possible.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Gina LaRoche and Jennifer Cohen, who are co-authors of a book called The Seven Laws of Enough, Cultivating a Life of Sustainable Abundance. The book is a really intriguing exploration of what it means to have enough. What does that word enough itself mean? What does it mean to live an abundant life, to enjoy abundance? And the contrary notion as well. What is scarcity, and how do we think of scarcity in our lives, and how do we sometimes get stuck in the scarcity story? Let's begin with that. I think it is very, very helpful that you take apart this notion of scarcity and this notion that we do not have enough. In fact, let's begin with something as elementary as that. Help us understand the word enough and the way in which we often use it and misuse it in our daily lives.
Well, the word enough, I think it's a tricky word, even if you think, like, what is enough? And we use that word really in an inquiry, like, what is enough? What's enough time? What's enough money? What's enough work? When have I done enough? I have this concept I call the enough line. How will I know when I've crossed to more than enough, or whenever and when do I don't have enough? So it really is an inquiry. For me, I know I've arrived in enough where there's some moment of a peace or a relaxation or a letting go that somehow I know personally that I have arrived there. We also see enough as a declaration, a possibility, a truth, an experience of the present moment where we're neither worried about the future nor dwelling in the past. And we see it as a gateway to a world where we can rest, recalibrate, and essentially rewrite or self-author a new future.
It's a really intriguing notion, and the kind of thing that we so often in life's frantic pace don't often sort of think about. The foreword of your book is written by someone who has been something of a mentor to you, Lynn Twist, the author of The Soul of Money. And I really appreciate her three toxic myths of scarcity that she lays out and that you quote. And I think this is very, very good food for thought. Can you talk us through those?
Lynn's articulation of the three myths of scarcity is there is not enough. That's the first myth, that we actually believe there's not enough to go around. We have a limited pie, and it's either you or me that's going to get a piece of that pie. The second myth is more is always better. More of everything is better. More time is better. More sex is better. More clothes are better. More square footage is better. More money is always better. More is better. And the third aspect of it is this is just the way that it is. That nobody made it up. We didn't construct it. Therefore, we can't reconstruct it. It's just the way that it is.
It's an
water we're swimming in.
It's an inescapable reality.
Inescapable reality. Really well said. Absolutely. So those are her three myths of scarcity. And we took more is better and expanded that and said there are also three myths of excess. If more is the antidote to lack, then there are three myths associated with more. And that those three myths are you can have it all. You can have everything. Having it all will make you happy. And if you don't have it all and or you're not happy, it is most definitely your fault.
And you need to be doing something different in order to achieve what you haven't yet achieved.
That's right. You need to be doing more of something, more of anything, more degrees, more time, more education, more this, more that. And then you will have it all. And if you don't, it's some fundamental flaw inside you.
Right. Exactly. And of course, when one walks into a bookstore and sees shelves and shelves and shelves of self-help books.
That's right.
In so many respects, that is what those books are written to address. And your book, of course, in one sense, part of that, yet apart from all that, because it's really trying to discard the whole notion that fuels that whole industry. Again, those three myths of excess, you can have it all. Having it all will make you happy, and if you don't have it all, you've done something wrong, or it's your fault. You explore that further in something that was so helpful to me in a section of this same chapter, in which you talk about what you call the weapons of scarcity. You write there are weapons being deployed to keep us under control. We call these the weapons of scarcity. They play us even when we think we're smart enough not to fall for them. Yet even the smartest of us fall into these traps. This is a fairly lengthy and alphabetical list. I'm not sure you should list all of it, but even if you give us some of these so-called weapons of scarcity, I think it would be really interesting for our listeners to hear this.
Yes, these weapons we have found not only in ourselves but with our clients. Some of them include comparison and competition, jealousy, resentment, worry. A lot of people worry. What I say are the two atomic bombs of the weapons of scarcity are fear and shame. And for many of us, we have these low-level conversations all day, every day, where I could point to a weapon of scarcity. Thanksgiving's coming up, obligation. Many people will go to their Thanksgiving meal out of obligation and not from a place of enoughness.
In this section of the book, there is a story that is told by a friend of yours involving some earrings. And boy, this is a poignant story. And if we just alter the details, it's a story that I'm pretty sure all of us have lived out in some way or another. Would you mind sharing this story with our listeners?
Sure. So a friend of ours worked where she worked. She had two friends who traveled quite a bit, and she could never travel. And when they would travel, they would go to fabulous places in Europe and Asia, and she couldn't go. And one time they came home from one of their trips with these fabulous earrings, and she was incredibly jealous. And not only do these women get to go on this fabulous trip, but they brought back these jeweled earrings. And she wanted them so badly, and forced her and her spouse to go to the store to buy the same, you know, as close of a match to the earrings. And given her budget and her finances at the time, she bought what she could afford, which were, you know, in her mind, less than the earrings that her friends got. And she brought them home and really discovered that she had there was no happiness there, no joy. And she never wore the earrings. She never wore them. And every time she would see them in her drawer, it actually reminded her and brought up pain and not the joy that she expected.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today with the co-authors of a book called The Seven Laws of Enough, Cultivating a Life of Sustainable Abundance. The co-authors, Gina LaRoche and Jennifer Cohen, are co-founders of the Seven Stones Leadership Group, and they have spoken extensively on this topic, reaching out to both individuals and organizations and companies to share some of the thoughts that they have on what true abundance really is. So the title of your book, we have yet to really thoroughly explore, that is The Seven Laws of Enough. Ahead of us kind of outlining those seven laws, I'd love to hear a little bit about the process by which you came up with them. I mean, how did you go about, in a sense, kind of sorting this out and creating this framework which helped make all of this make sense to you and make sense to us? How did these seven laws take shape?
Through a lot of experimentation, really. We were, I think I mentioned it at the very beginning, or maybe not, that we were part of a collective of colleagues exploring this idea that some of them had been exposed to through Lynn Twist, this idea of sufficiency, that we are enough, we do enough, we have enough. There actually is not a small, scarce pie to fight over. There's a place to stand of enoughness and then a way to create enough in the world. And we spent a lot of time talking about this idea and these distinctions and ran a lot of experiments and inquiries, which are now part of the book. And it literally, the seven laws are what we discovered after marinating, baking ourselves in the inquiry for more than a decade. We discovered that stories matter, that we're enough, that we belong. We can go through all seven laws. Greg, I think you mentioned that we will. I won't steal that part of it right now. But that's what we found out to be true for us and really laid out the seven laws to be signposts, to be a way for people to know they were in the territory of enoughness, the territory of sustainable abundance, instead of the territory of scarcity. The territory of scarcity is filled with the weapons of scarcity that Gina just outlined, and there are more of them in the book, and other pitfalls.
Hmm. And I think that's what you're talking about when you say time and time again in the book, this notion of being stuck in the scarcity story. And and what these seven laws of enough are really about is sort of carrying one to a place that's outside of that scarcity story in which we can so easily find ourselves entrenched.
Yes, there's a beautiful poem by a Sufi poet named Rumi that some of your listeners may have heard of. And the poem goes something like this. Outside of right doing and wrongdoing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. And outside the story of scarcity and excess, there's a field that we call sustainable abundance. And the laws allow us to meet in that field.
Mm. The first of these seven laws is stories matter. Of the seven laws, that's probably the one that at a glance made the least amount of sense to me. I mean, not that I don't firmly believe that, and as the son of a semi-professional storyteller, I'm probably more acquainted than most with the importance of stories. But just at a glance, I didn't understand how stories matter should necessarily be part of this conversation. I eventually came to understand it, of course, as I read the chapter. But for our listeners, too, I suspect upon hearing that this might not make immediate sense. What is the significance of stories, of our own stories, in this whole matter of abundance?
Well, the stories that we tell ourselves, the stories we're born into, the stories of how the United States were formed, all shape us. Actually shape who we are, how we think, the decisions we make. They shape our context, and what we like to say, that context is decisive. So the story of gender can dictate how we live our entire life. The story of race, I'm a Black woman, can dictate what my experience is of living this life. And then we have like the story of our country. I often have this thought experiment of what if we had signed the Declaration of Interdependence instead of the Declaration of Independence? How would that have reshaped who we are as a nation and the journey we have been on together? So the story of scarcity is a story.
Hmm.
And
it's a story. It's a story that we tell ourselves, even if we aren't even particularly conscious of the fact that that's what we're doing.
Exactly. When you open your eyes, your first thought is, I didn't get enough sleep. I don't have enough time.
I'm late. Like, those are all stories we're telling ourselves, all in scarcity.
Hmm. I especially appreciated in this chapter a moment when you kind of take apart the tools by which we construct our stories, three tools of speech with which we create our stories, through declarations, assessments, and assertions. Why did you think it was important to be thinking about those sorts of tools? Why does it matter to be aware of our declarations, assessments, and assertions?
Because if we're made of stories and we live inside story after story after story, it's valuable to understand how they're constructed. Sustainable abundance is also a story. And what we say in our leadership work, Greg, to the leaders we coach, some of them global leaders, is leaders make up new stories about the future. That's what they do. They say India will be free. They say truth and reconciliation. They say we'll be judged by the content of our character. Well, they say we're going to go to the moon. And those are powerful declarations. And then we live inside assertions and assessments to build those stories, to architect those stories, and invite people to join us. And those stories have enough power to create global movements. So if we want to equip our readers and we want to equip everyone with the capacity to build stories that are sustaining of life for the future of life on Earth, they're not just about abundance. They're about sustainable abundance. We never separate those two words.
Hmm.
And that is incredibly deliberate on our part. But we want our readers to be equipped to build stories for a future that are going to support life, support their children, support their grandchildren. And while this is not a thorough articulation of how to build stories, we wanted to give people a little bit of an understanding of the building blocks of stories. And that's through these elements and language that were articulated by Fernando Flores originally.
Right. I like a lot of what you say about stories and their importance. And I also appreciate what comes at the very end of this chapter. And it comes at the end of each of these chapters devoted to each of the seven laws, where then you talk about practices. That is, some tangible ways to put into practice what has been discussed in the preceding chapter. And I wonder if you could, for instance, take us through, there's a number of practices with each of these, and I especially liked two of what you suggest with this law of stories matter, one involving morning, noon, and evening for somebody, and also the writing of one's emotional autobiography. Could you just briefly touch on the reason for these two practices, the kind of benefit that they could be for somebody?
Sure. Well, first of all, I will say that all of the practices are in there with a desire for us to help break old habits and create new ones, really through awareness and an unwinding to interrupt our normal behaviors, and then a capacity building. So all the practices are there to address one of those three elements at least. The daily inventory self-inquiry is something that I created. I really spend a lot of time in practice and in inquiry, and I wanted to have touch stones throughout the day, because even if we have a morning meditation practice, the second we get on the subway to work, or we walk into the office, or we walk into the classroom, we could forget. We tend to forget our practices, and we go straight into work and busyness. And so I wanted an opportunity for people, even if it was just one question, just to be an inquiry about when upon waking and at lunchtime and in the evening. So questions about who or what is nourishing me, and what can I acknowledge and appreciate myself for in this moment? And what am I grateful for, and where did I feel connected today? And these are inquiries that have inspired us, and we encourage you to develop your own inquiries. The emotional autobiography is really adapted from work that we have done at the Strozzi Institute, and it's an opportunity for you to write down your story, your emotional story of where you've come from, really so we can heal, so we can build community, so we can reinterpret the past and create a future. And ultimately, our hope is that telling this story, telling this emotional autobiography, will break down any isolation. So that's why those practices in particular are in there. And the practices throughout the book are really designed not as the answer, but as a answer, a path. And we encourage you to develop, our readers to develop their own practices. And some of the practices in the book are from our clients and folks we have met along the way who have developed their own practices and allowed us to share with our audience.
We're speaking with Gina LaRoche and Jennifer Cohen about their book, The Seven Laws of Enough, Cultivating a Life of Sustainable Abundance. We won't be nearly so thorough, of course, with the other six laws, but I certainly want to touch on each of them. And, of course, the second of the seven laws is particularly important. It's three simple words, I am enough. And repeatedly in this chapter, what we read the phrase, the journey to enoughness. I think this is so intriguing. What kind of journey are we typically talking about? And is it a journey that tends to be a smooth and uninterrupted arc? Or is the typical journey to enoughness a different sort of journey?
I had one teacher, a dear teacher, Richard Strozzi Heckler. He would always say, he probably still does, he would always say, it's three steps forward and two steps back. So I would not say smooth and uninterrupted for any journey. And as Gina articulated earlier, it's both a journey and a place to stand and a declaration. I am enough is a moment in time where we declare it, where we take the debate off the table. And then the journey is to what we call embodying it, so that it is no longer something we remember and forget, but we live inside it. We live inside it like the debate really is off the table. It's no longer a question. And the journey looks different for each person. For people for whom self-loathing and self-aversion is incredibly deep, it can be a longer walk home to the truth of our enoughness. And for some people who are luckier, for whatever reason, luck, circumstances, the stories they got to live in about love and about themselves and about their community, they remember more often already that they are enough and need fewer reminders. And it takes a shorter time, to inhabit it. So, you know, to each his or her own, so to speak.
Right. I would love to have you touch on a lovely moment in this chapter in which you talk about the tools of sufficiency that, in a sense, are completely at odds with what we were talking about earlier, the weapons of scarcity, the tools of sufficiency, a lengthy list that can be very, very helpful in sort of helping us step towards this notion of enoughness. Share whatever you want from this intriguing list.
Yeah, when we find ourselves noticing that we are in comparison mode or obligation or in self-loathing or fear or shame, these tools are to help you find a place of enoughness or sufficiency in the present moment. And some of the tools are include gratitude, just noticing what we're grateful for in the moment. It could be generosity, offering to buy lunch for your coworker. We Inquiry is a tool, like bringing curiosity to a situation. And then ultimately, you know, one of the greatest tools to bring to bear in this scarce society is this tool of love.
It is
the antidote to fear. It really is the antidote to fear.
Absolutely. That's kind of where this all ultimately leads us. Law number three is I belong. And I appreciated the fact that these simple words are explored in more than one respect. I mean there's more than one way to think about belonging, and you don't leave it as a simple matter given just a glance, but really want to explore this. In what ways do we need to go beyond the obvious in this notion of belonging?
I'm not sure belonging is obvious, Greg, to many, many people on this planet at this point. There's very few people for whom their belonging is obvious, I think, and that's in part why we wrote the chapter or call it a law. From our point of view, when you're inside the field, inside that space of sustainable abundance, it's impossible to discern. It's impossible for any one human or group of humans to say, this set of people belongs and this other set does not. We were all brought here. We were all given life. We were all equally invited to this earth. And back to your question about faith, different people have different understandings of how that happened or why that happened. But from our point of view, everybody belongs here equally, and it's not ours to say that they don't.
I appreciate the truth behind law number four. No one is exempt, which spells out the fact that, in fact, a lot of us like to think of ourselves as somehow exempt from certain harsh realities of life. Mm-hmm. And you clearly believe it's important for us to be shaken loose from this notion.
Yes, we
We do believe that.
You know, essentially, we cannot insulate ourselves from life's ups and downs. And actually, Greg, there's freedom when we stop trying. I noticed a simple thing. I was on an airplane last week, and I noticed that I thought I was exempt from sitting in the middle seat. And I was sitting on the aisle and looking, and I'm like, I'll never sit in the middle seat. And I was like, oh, that's exemption. But that's trivial. But we also think we should be exempt from sickness. Some of us actually believe we should be exempt from aging and even death. And no one has figured that out yet, and neither will you. As I like to say, no one is exempt, not even me. And essentially, you know, the Buddhists say there are the 10,000 sorrows, and we're not exempt from the 10,000 sorrows. But neither are we exempt from the 10,000 joys. So back to the Zen thing, someone who's deep in self-loathing, you are allowed to have the 10,000 joys. They're here for you, too.
Nicely
That's
said.
The abundance part, Greg. That's the abundance side of it. The 10,000 joys are available to all of us.
Absolutely. So the laws that remain, resting is required, and this is important wisdom for a whole lot of us, even those of us who are busy but with things that we absolutely love to do. Rest is important for us, and of course, every bit is important for those where life is full of things that keep them busy in ways that deplete them, and you explore all kinds of different ways in which one can find better rest. In the chapter called Joy is Available, you explore how joy needs to be at the heart of all of this, and you in particular take some time talking about humor. And it was really interesting. You take a moment to talk about how we often use humor as a weapon or a shield. And you suggest that humor actually is meant for a higher calling than that.
Yes, we do suggest that. And, you know, if you're in one context, humor becomes a weapon, a tool of alienation, a way to humiliate other people, a way to separate us, a way to exacerbate the not belonging. And in the context of sustainable abundance, humor is for health, for lightness. And what we find is that as we rest in the other laws, all the previous laws, as we rest in resting, as we rest in not being exempt, as we belong and our enoughness, and we settle into those, joy arises. In our culture, we go for excitement, the roller coaster, the next pleasure, the Apple Watch, the new car. But that's not joy, that's excitement. Joy is what bubbles up from the inside when we're in a space of true contentment. And that's what we're after.
Right. And of course, where this all takes us ultimately is the seventh and final law: love is the answer. And I don't think too many people would argue with that. And I think that chapter very, very nicely ties all of this together in a really meaningful way. I especially love the part where you talk about love is a verb, a place to stand, a choice, a call from deep within. Our anatomy and physiology are designed for it. Love is letting go of how we thought it was supposed to be. Love is seeing yourself and another clearly. Love is knowing what you hold most dear and being willing to fight for it. Love is the welling up of gratitude that comes when you feel yourself truly connected to all beings. Love is someone standing for you when you don't know how to stand for yourself. Love is acceptance, the ability to be with it all, the parts we like, the parts we hate, the parts we wish would just disappear. Love is finding out that none of it deserves to be discarded, that it all has a place, that all of it belongs, that all of you belongs, and on and on. To finish out, I think you want to say something about this upcoming Thanksgiving holiday, and you have suggestions on some things that people might think about.
Yes, Greg. I often I hear that people talk about what's the conversation at Thanksgiving table, and we offer you some inquiry questions to bring to your Thanksgiving conversations that hopefully will bring you as a family and friends at the table closer to sustainable abundance rather than scarcity. And the first question is, what is the highlight of the past year? Second question is, what are the lessons learned? And then the third question is, what are your hopes and dreams for the year ahead? And obviously, you can do that at Thanksgiving, at Hanukkah, at Christmas, at Kwanzaa, but also for your birthday and any other celebration.
A wonderful, wonderful idea as we celebrate another holiday devoted to the notion of gratitude and abundance and coming to a better understanding of what real abundance is. The book, once again, is called The Seven Laws of Enough: Cultivating a Life of Sustainable Abundance, published by Parallax Press. The co-authors, Gina LaRoche and Jennifer Cohen. My thanks to both of you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I so enjoyed your book and so much enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for both and best wishes.
You're welcome, Greg. Best wishes to you. Happy holiday. Thank you.
And there is no morning show on tomorrow, nor on Friday because of the Thanksgiving holiday. On behalf behalf of all of us here at WGTD, I hope that you and yours have a very safe and happy holiday, and I hope that you will come back to join us for morning shows next week. We'll have all kinds of interesting things for you, including an interview about a brand new play.